1801. So I guess what I'm saying, Mr. Attorney General, if I buy your argument about FISA, I can't think of a reason you wouldn't have the ability, if you chose to set aside the statute on torture if you believed it impeded the war effort.
Well, Senator, whether or not we set aside a statute, of course, is not...
An inherent authority sets aside the statute.
That's not what we're talking about here. We don't need to get to that tough question.
If you don't buy the force resolution argument, if we somehow magically took that off the table, that's all you're left with is the inherent authority, and Congress could tomorrow change that resolution. And that's dangerous for the country if we get in a political fight over that. All I'm saying is the inherent authority argument in its application, to me, seems to have no boundaries when it comes to executive decisions in a time of war. It deals the Congress out. It deals the courts out. And, Mr. Attorney General, there is a better way, and on our next round of questioning, we will talk about that better way.
Sir, can I simply make one quick response, Mr. Chairman?
You may respond, Attorney General.
Well, the fact that the President may have inherent authority doesn't mean that Congress has no authority in a particular area. And we look at the words of the Constitution, and there are clear grants of authority to the Congress in a time of war. And so if you're talking about competing constitutional interests, that's when you get into sort of the third part of the Jackson analysis.
That's where we're at right now.
I don't believe that's where we're at right now, sir.
That's where you're at with me.
Sir, even under the third part of the Jackson analysis, again, I haven't done the detailed work that obviously these kinds of questions require. These are tough questions, but I believe that the President does have the authority under the Constitution.
Thank you, Senator Graham. Senator Schumer?
Charles Schumer, Democrat from New York.
General Gonzalez, I just want to make a couple of points that are important to keep in mind as we ask you questions. First, we all support a strong, robust, and vigorous national security program. Like everyone else in this room, I want the President to have all the legal tools he needs as we work together to keep our nation safe and free, including wiretapping. And I appreciate the difficult job you and the President have balancing security and liberty. That is not an easy one. But I firmly believe that we can have both security and rule of law. And I'm sure you agree with that, General Gonzalez,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, Senator.
And that's what distinguishes us from so many other nations, including our enemies. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, the first job of government is to protect our security, and everyone on this committee supports that. But another important job of government is to enforce the rule of law, because the temptation to abuse the enormous power of the government is very real. And that's why we have checks and balances. They're at the fulcrum of our democracy. You agree with that?
I agree with that, Senator.
I have to say, by the way, that's why I'm disappointed that Chairman Specter wouldn't let us show the clip of the President's speech. Senator Specter said that the transcript speaks for itself. But seeing the speech with its nuances is actually very different from reading the record. And when you watch the speech, it seems clear that the President isn't simply talking about roving wiretaps. He's talking about all wiretaps. Because the fact that you don't wiretap citizens without a warrant has been a bedrock of American principles for decades. Nonetheless, having said that, I am gratified that these hearings have been a lot less partisan than the previous ones we held in this room. And many Republican colleagues have voiced concerns about the administration policy. I want to salute my Republican colleagues for questioning some of these policies, Chairman Specter and Senator DeWine, Senator Brownback, Senator Graham, and others. But it's not just Republican senators who seriously questioned the NSA program, but very high-ranking officials within the administration itself. Now, you've already acknowledged that there were lawyers in the administration who expressed reservations about the NSA program. There was dissent. Is that right?
Of course, Senator. This, as I indicated, this program implicates some very difficult issues. The war on terror has generated several issues that are very, very complicated.
Understood.
Lawyers disagree.
I concede all those points. Let me ask you about some specific reports. It's been reported by multiple news outlets that the former number two man in the Justice Department, The premier terrorism prosecutor, Jim Comey, expressed grave reservations about the NSA program and at least once refused to give it his blessing. Is that true?
Senator, here's a response that I feel that I can give with respect to recent speculation or stories about disagreements. There has not been any serious disagreement, including, and I think this is accurate, there's not been any serious disagreement about the program that the president has confirmed. There have been disagreements about other matters regarding operations, which I cannot get into. I will also say...
But there was some... I'm sorry to cut you off, but there was some dissent within the administration, and Jim Comey did express at some point, that's all I asked you, reservations.
The point I want to make is that, to my knowledge, none of the reservations dealt with the program that we're talking about today. They dealt with operational capabilities that we're not talking about today.
I want to ask you again about them. We have limited time.
Yes, sir.
It's also been reported that the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Jack Goldsmith, respected lawyer and professor at Harvard Law School, expressed reservations about the program. Is that true?
Senator, rather than going individual, let me just say that I think the differing views that have been the subject of some of these stories did not deal with the program that I'm here testifying about today.
But you are telling us that none of these people expressed any reservations about the ultimate program. Is that right?
Senator, I want to be very careful here because, of course, I'm here only testifying about what the president has confirmed. And with respect to what the president has confirmed, I do not believe that these DOJ officials that you're identifying had concerns about this program.
There are other reports. I'm sorry to. You're not giving me a yes or no answer here. I understand that. Newsweek reported that several Department of Justice lawyers were so concerned about the legal basis for the NSA program that they went so far as to line up private lawyers. Do you know if that's true?
I do not know if that's true.
Now let me just ask you a question. Here. You mentioned earlier that you had no problem with Attorney General Ashcroft, someone else. I didn't want to ask you about him. He's your predecessor. People have said have doubts, but you said that you had no problem with him coming before this committee and testifying when Senator Specter asked. Is that right?
Senator, who the chairman chooses to call as a witness is up to the chairman.
The administration doesn't object to that.
Obviously,
they?
The administration, by saying that we would have no objections, doesn't mean that we would waive any privileges that
I understand.
Might exist.
I got that.
That's and up
but
to the
I
chairman.
Assume they're the same. The same would go for Mr. Comey, Mr. Goldsmith, and any other individuals. Assuming you didn't waive executive privilege, you wouldn't have an objection to them coming before this committee.
Attorney-client privilege, deliberative privilege, to the extent that there are privileges, it is up to the chairman to decide who he wants to call as a witness. But let me just say that if we're engaged in a debate about what the law is and the position of the administration, that is my job, and that's what I'm doing here today.
And you are doing your job, and that's why I am requesting, as I have in the past, but renewing it here today, reaffirmed even more strongly by your testimony and everything else, that we invite these people, that we invite former Attorney General Ashcroft, Deputy Attorney General Comey, OLC Chair Goldsmith to this hearing and actually compel them to come if they won't on their own. And as for privilege,
If I may interrupt you for just one
please.
Moment.
Chairman Specter.
Yes, thank you.
I think the record was in great shape where I left it. If you bring in Attorney General Ashcroft, that's a critical step.
Right.
It wasn't that I hadn't thought of Mr. Comey and Mr. Goldsmith and other people, but I sought to leave the record with the agreement of the Attorney General to bring in former Attorney General Ashcroft.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I respect that. I think others are important as well, but I want to get to
the issue of privilege here. I'm not saying they aren't important. I'm just saying what's the best way to get them here?
Okay. Well, whatever way we can, I'd be all for. On privilege, because that's going to be the issue even if they come here, as I'm sure you will acknowledge, Mr. Chairman. I take it you'd have no problem with them talking about their general views on the legality of this program, just as you are talking about those. Well, not to go into the specific details of what happened back then, but their general views on the legality of these programs. You have any problem with that?
General views of the program that the president has confirmed, Senator, that's, again, if we're talking about the general views of the
I just want them to be able to testify as freely as you've testified here, because it wouldn't be fair if you're an advocate of administration policies, you have one set of rules, and if you're an opponent or a possible opponent of administration policies, you have another set of rules. That's not unfair, is it?
Sir, it's up to the chairman to...
No, but would you or the administration, you as the chief legal officer, have any problem with them testifying in the same way you did about general legal views of the program?
I would defer to the chairman.
I'm not asking you, sir, in all due respect. I'm not asking you what the chairman thinks. He's doing a good job here, and I don't begrudge that one
bit. Sir, my answer
is I'm asking you what the administration would think in terms of exercising any claim of privilege.
And again,
you're not going to have, I'm sorry here, you're not going to have different rules for yourself, an administration advocate, than for these people who might be administration dissenters in one way or another, are you?
Well, sir, I don't know. I don't know if you're asking me what are they going to say.
I'm not asking you that. Would the rules be the same? I think you can answer that yes or no.
If they came to testify?
Correct.
Well, sir, the client here is the President of the United States. I'm not sure it's in my place to offer offer up a position or my recommendation to you about what I might recommend to the President of the United States.
What
would not
be
appropriate here.
I just am asking you as a very fine, well-educated lawyer. Should or could the rules be any different for what you are allowed to say with privilege hovering over your head and what they are allowed to say with those same privileges hovering over their heads? Should the rules be any different? If you can't say yes to that, then then that's fundamentally unfair. It's saying that these hearings, or that it's saying really that the administration doesn't have the confidence to get out the whole truth.
Sir, my hesitation quite frankly, I haven't thought recently about the issue about former employees coming to testify about their legal analysis or their legal recommendations to their client. And that is the source of my hesitation.
Okay, I was
Senator
just my
Schumer,
time.
Senator Schumer, take two more minutes for my interruption.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Providing you move to another subject.
Well, okay. I think this is very important, Mr. Chairman.
Well,
I think
too.
You
if
would agree.
Were, if this okay. were a courtroom, I'd move to strike yep. all your questions and his answers because the record was so much better off before.
Yep. Well, I don't buy that,
but
Mr. Chairman.
But take two more minutes on the condition stated.
No, I don't buy that. I think we have to try to tie down as much as we can here, okay? Let me go to another bit of questions here. You said, Mr. Attorney General, that the AUMF allowed the president, that's one of the legal justifications, the Constitution, to go ahead with this program. Now, under your legal theory, could the government, without ever going to a judge or getting a warrant, search an American's home or office?
Well, of course, Senator, any act authorization or activity by the president would be subject to the Fourth Amendment. And what you're talking about, I mean, I presume you're talking about a law enforcement effort. This is not a law enforcement.
Let me interrupt for a minute. Aren't wiretaps subject to the Fourth Amendment as well?
Of course
okay,
they are.
So they're both subject. What would prevent the president's theory, your theory, from, given the danger, given maybe some of the difficulties, from going this far?
Well, sir,
I have to go down to start the debate on this.
It's hard to answer a hypothetical question in the way that you've posed it in terms of how far do the president's authorities extend. However far they may extend, Senator, they clearly extend so far as to allow the president of the United States to engage in electronic surveillance of the enemy during a time of war.
Would he engage in electronic surveillance when the phone calls both originated and ended in the United States if there were al-Qaeda suspects?
I think that question was asked earlier. I've said I don't believe that we've done the analysis on that.
I asked, what do you think the theory is?
That's a different situation, Senator. And, again, these kind of constitutional questions, I would, you know, I could offer up a guess, but these are hard questions.
Has this come up? Has it happened?
Sir, what the president has authorized is only international phone calls.
I understand. Has there been a situation brought to your attention where there were Al-Qaeda call, someone suspected of being part of Al-Qaeda or another terrorist group calling someone from the United States to the United States?
Sir, now you're getting into sort of operations, and I'm not going to respond to that.
I'm not asking any specific. I'm asking ever.
You're asking about how this program has operated, and I'm not going to answer that question, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Schumer. Senator Cornyn.
John Cornyn, Republican of Texas.
Comments, Mr. Chairman, about this not being a court of law are apt, because I don't think we're going to get resolution about the disagreement among lawyers as to what the legal answer is. But I do believe it's important to have the hearing and to air the various points of view. But I would hope, and I trust, is along the lines of what Senator Schumer stated, is that there would be a consensus on the committee and throughout the Congress that we should use all legal means available to us to gather actionable intelligence that has the potential of saving American lives. You certainly would agree with that, wouldn't you, General Gonzalez?
Yes, Senator.
And some have stated that have stated the question like this. They said, well, has the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was passed in 1978, authorized the president to conduct this particular program? I have a couple of problems with that question stated that way. Number one, the technology has surpassed what it was in 1978, so our capacity to gain actionable intelligence has certainly changed. And the very premise of the question suggests that the president can only exercise the authority that Congress confers. And when people talk about the law that pertains to this particular question is not just the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, but it includes the Constitution and the authorization for use of military force. Would you agree with that, General Gonzalez?
Senator, you raise a very important point. People focus on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and say, this is what the words say, and that's the end of it. If you're not following it in total, you're obviously in violation of the law. That is only the beginning of the analysis. You have to look to see what Congress has done subsequent to that. And then, of course, you have to look at the Constitution. There have been many statements today about no one is above the law. And I would simply remind, and I know this doesn't need to be stated, but no one is above the Constitution either, not even the Congress.
And clearly the Supreme Court in the Hamdi case said what we all know to be the fact, and that is no president is above the law. No person in this country, regardless of how exalted their position may be or how relatively modest their position may be. We're all governed by the Constitution and laws of the United States.
During my confirmation hearings, I talked about Justice O'Connor's statement from Hamdi that a state of war is not a blank check for the President of the United States. And I said in my hearings that I agree with that.
General Gonzalez, I regret to say that when I was just a few minutes ago watching the crawler or the caption on a cable news network, it referred to domestic surveillance. Which strikes me as a fundamental error in the accuracy of the reporting of what's going on here. You made clear that what's been authorized here is not domestic surveillance. That is starting from and ending in the United States. This is an international surveillance with known Al-Qaeda operatives, correct?
I think people who call this a domestic surveillance program is doing a disservice to the American people. It would be like flying from Texas to Poland and saying that's a domestic flight. We know that's not true. That would be an international flight. And what we're talking about are international communications. And so I agree with your point, Senator.
With regard to the authorization of the use of military force, some have questioned whether it was actually discussed in Congress, whether surveillance of international phone calls between Al-Qaeda overseas and here, whether that was actually in the minds of individual members of Congress when they voted to support the authorization of the use of military force. It strikes me as odd to say that Congress authorized the commander-in-chief to capture, to detain, to kill, if necessary, Al-Qaeda. But we can't listen to their phone calls, and we can't gather intelligence to find out what they're doing so we can prevent future attacks against the American people. Now, you've explained your legal analysis with regard to the Hamdi decision and explaining that intelligence is a fundamental incident of war. And I think that makes good sense. And here again, you know, I realize we have some very fine lawyers on the committee, and there are a lot of lawyers around the country who've opined on this, some who've been negative, some who've been positive. I was struck by the fact that John Schmidt, who was Associate Attorney General during the Clinton Justice Department, wrote what I thought was an eloquent op-ed piece for the Chicago Tribune dated December the 21st, 2005, agreeing with the administration's point of view. But that's only to point out that lawyers, regardless of their party affiliation, will have perhaps differing views. But again, I would hope that what we're not engaged in is either a partisan debate or even an ideological debate, but a legal debate on what the Constitution and laws of the United States provide for. Let me turn to another subject that's caused me a lot of concern, and that is our espionage laws and the laws that criminalize the intentional leaking of classified information. It's my understanding from the news reports that the Department of Justice has undertaken an investigation to see whether those who actually leaked this program to the New York Times or any other media outlet might have violated our espionage laws. Is that correct?
I can confirm, Senator, that an investigation has been initiated.
Does that investigation also include any potential violation for publishing that information?
Senator, I'm not going to get into specific laws that are being looked at, but obviously our prosecutors are going to look to see all the laws that have been violated, and if the evidence is there, they're going to prosecute those violations.
Well, you may give me the same answer to this next question, but I'm wondering, is there any exclusion or immunity for the New York Times or any other person to receive information from a lawbreaker seeking to divulge classified information? Is there any explicit protection? The law says that if you receive that and you publish it, you are somehow immune from a criminal investigation?
Senator, I'm sure the New York Times has their own great set of lawyers, and I would hate in this public forum to provide them my views as to what would be a legitimate defense.
Well, there's a lot of very strange circumstances surrounding this initial report in the New York Times, including the fact that the New York Times apparently sat on the story for a year. And then, of course, the coincidence, some might say, that the story was broken on the date that Congress was going to vote, the Senate was going to vote on reauthorization of the Patriot Act. But we'll leave that perhaps for another day. I believe I will yield the rest of my time back. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Cornyn.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois.
During the course of this hearing, you have referred to FISA several times as a useful tool in wiretapping and surveillance. And I've thought about that phrase because it's a phrase that's been used by the White House, too. Referring to FISA as a useful tool in wiretapping is like referring to speed limits and troopers with radar guns as useful tools on a motoring trip. I think FISA is not there as a useful tool to the administration. It is there as a limitation on the power of a president when it comes to wiretapping. And I think your use of that phrase, useful tool, captures the attitude of this administration toward this law. We'll use it when it doesn't cause a problem. We'll ignore it when we have to. And I think that's why we're here today. And I'm curious, Mr. Attorney General, as we get into this, and I look back on some of your previous testimony and what you've said to this committee in confirmation hearings and the like, how far will this administration go under the theories which you've stated today to ignore or circumvent laws like FISA? I asked you during the course of the last, or your confirmation hearing, a question about this whole power of the Commander-in-Chief.
And a poster board with the transcript of this moment from the hearings is being put up in the committee hearing room.
Take place. But I do believe that if I could play it, you would be asked to explain your answer to a question, which I posed to you. And the question was this. Mr. Attorney General, has this president ever invoked that authority as Commander-in-Chief or otherwise to conclude that a law was unconstitutional and refused to comply with it? Mr. Gonzalez, I believe that I stated in my June briefing about these memos that the president has not exercised that authority. You've said to us today several times that the president is claiming his power for this domestic spying, whatever you want to call it, terrorist surveillance program, because of the president's inherent powers, his core constitutional authority of the executive branch. And so I have to ask you point blank, as Senator Feingold asked you earlier, you knew when you answered my question that this administration had decided that it was going to basically find a way around the FISA law based on the president's, as you called it, inherent constitutional powers. So how can your response be valid today in light of what we now know?
Oh, it's absolutely valid, Senator. And this is going to sound repetitious, but it has never been our position that we are circumventing or ignoring FISA. Quite the contrary. The president has authorized activities that are totally consistent with FISA, with what FISA contemplates. I have indicated that I believe that, putting aside the question of the authorization to use military force, that while it's a tough legal question as to whether or not Congress has the authority under the Constitution to cabin or to limit the president's constitutional authority to engage in electronic surveillance of the enemy, that is not a question that we even need to get to. It has always been our position that FISA can be and must be read in a way that it doesn't infringe upon the president's constitutional authority.
So let me read to you what your own Justice Department just issued within the last few weeks in relation to the president's authority, the NSA program, and FISA. Because the president, and I quote, because the president also has determined that NSA activities are necessary to defense of the United States from a subsequent terrorist attack in the armed conflict with al-Qaeda, I quote, FISA would impermissibly interfere with the president's most solemn constitutional obligation to defend the United States against foreign attack. You can't have it both ways.
And that's why...
You can't tell me that you're not circumventing it and then publish this and say that FISA interferes with the president's constitutional authority.
And that's why you have to interpret FISA in a way where you don't tee up that very difficult constitutional question under the canons of constitutional avoidance.
What you have to do is take out the express language in FISA, which says it is the exclusive means. It is exclusive. And the way you take it out is by referring to, and I think you've said it over and over here again, well, you just have to look to that phrase, you say, except as otherwise authorized by statute. Senator Feinstein and I were struggling. We're looking through FISA. Where is that phrase, except as otherwise authorized by statute? It's not in FISA. It's not in the FISA law. You may find it in the criminal statute and may want to adopt it by reference, but this FISA law, signed by a president and the law of the land, is the exclusive way that a president can wiretap. And I want to ask you, if this is exclusive, why didn't you take advantage of the fact that you had and the president had such a strong bipartisan support for fighting terrorism that we gave the president the Patriot Act with only one dissenting vote? We've supported this president with every dollar he's asked for to fight terrorism. Why didn't you come to this Congress and say there are certain things we need to change, which you characterized as cumbersome and burdensome in FISA? Why didn't you work with us to make the law better and stronger and more effective when you knew that you had a bipartisan consensus behind you?
Senator, the primary criminal code criminal provision in FISA, Section 109, 50 U.S.C. 1809, it is page 179 if you've got one of these books, provides that a person is guilty of an offense if he intentionally engages in electronic surveillance under color of law except as authorized by statute. This provision means that you have to engage in electronic surveillance as provided here except as otherwise provided by statute. And this is a provision that we're relying upon. It's in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
It's Title 18. But let me just tell you, what you don't want to read
not
to us...
Sir, it's not Title 18.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978 shall be the exclusive means by which electronic surveillance, as defined in Section 101 of such act, interception of domestic wire or electronic communication, may be conducted. And so what you said is, well, when you authorized the war, you must have known that we were going to really expand beyond FISA. I've got the book here. You can look through it if you like. There's not a single reference in our passing, this AUMF that we've talked about, authorized use of military force, not a single reference to surveillance and intelligence in the manner that you've described it.
So there's probably not a single reference to detainment of American citizens either, but the Supreme Court has said that is exactly what you've authorized, because
read,
it is a fundamental incident of waging war.
So since you've quoted that repeatedly, let me read what that court has said. We conclude, Hamdi decision, we conclude that detention of individuals falling into the limited category we are considering for the duration of the particular conflict in which they are captured is so fundamental and accepted an incident to war to be an exercise of necessary and appropriate force.
No question, that case was not about electronic surveillance. I will concede that.
But I'll tell you something else, Mr. Attorney General. If you then read, I think, the fine reasoning of Justice O'Connor, she comes to a point which brings us here today, and I thank the chairman for allowing us to be here today. And this is what she says in the course of this decision. It is during our most challenging and uncertain moments that our nation's commitment to due process is most severely tested. And it is in those times that we must preserve our commitment at home to the principles for which we fight abroad. We have said repeatedly, as nominees for the Supreme Court have come here, do you accept the basis of Hamdi, that a war is not a blank check for a president? They have said yes. That's consistent with Jackson and Youngstown.
And
now what we hear from you is that you are going to take this decision in Hamdi and build it into a way to avoid the most basic statute when it comes to electronic surveillance in America, a statute which describes itself as the exclusive means by which this government can legally do this.
Senator, I think that in reading that provision you just cited to, you have to consider Section 109. Section 109 contemplates an additional authorization by the Congress. Congress provided that additional authorization when it authorized the use of military force following the attacks of 9/11.
Well, last thing I'd like to say, and I only have a minute to go, is the greatest fear that we have is that what this president is now claiming is going to go far beyond what you've described today. What you've described today is something we would all join in on a bipartisan basis to support. Use every wiretap capacity you have to stop dangerous terrorists from hurting Americans. If you came to Capitol Hill and asked us to change a law in a reasonable way to reach that goal, you'd have the same bipartisan support. Our concern is what this president is asking for will allow this administration to comb through thousands of ordinary Americans' emails and phone calls. In the audience today is Richard Flesher of Willowbrook, Illinois. I don't know if Mr. Flesher is still here. Mr. Flesher wrote to the NSA and asked if he had been wiretapped because he had had conversations with people overseas. And after several letters that he sent back and forth, the best he could get from the National Security Administration is that they would neither confirm nor deny the existence of records responsive to his request. Ordinary Americans wondering if their telephone calls, if their emails overseas have been wiretapped, and there is no safeguard for their liberty and freedom. What we have today is your announcement that career professionals and experts will watch out for the freedoms of America. Career professionals and experts, sadly, in our nation's history, have done things in the past that we're not proud of. Career professionals have made bad decisions. Japanese internment camps, enemies list. What we really rely on is the rule of law and the Constitution, safeguards we can trust by people we can see. And when it comes to some person working at NSA, I don't think it gives us much comfort.
Thank you, Senator Durbin. Before yielding to Senator Brownback, I want to announce that I'm going to have to excuse myself for just a few minutes. We are starting on floor debate this afternoon at 3 o'clock on the asbestos reform bill, on which Senator Leahy and I are co-sponsors, and I am scheduled to start the debate at 3 o'clock, and I will return as soon as I have made a floor statement. And in the interim, Senator Hatch has agreed to chair the hearing. Senator Brownback, you're recognized.
Sam Brownback, Republican of Kansas.
Appreciate the hearing. Attorney General, thank you for being here. I want to look at the reason we're in this war on terrorism. I want to talk about the length of time we may be in this war on terrorism, and then I want to look at FISA's use forward from this point in the war on terrorism. I don't need to remind the Attorney General, but I certainly would my colleagues, that we are very actively engaged in a war on terrorism today. January 19th of this year, Osama bin Laden in a tape says this, quote, "The reason why we didn't have such an operation will take place, and you will see such operations by the grace of God." And by that, he's talking about more 9/11s, and that was January 19th, 2006. Al-Zawahiri, number two person, January 30th of this year, says this, "Bush, do you know where I am? I'm among the Muslim masses enjoying their care with God's blessings and sharing with them their holy war against you until we defeat you, God willing. The Lion of Islam, Sheikh Osama bin Laden, may God protect him, offered you a decent exit from your dilemma, but your leaders, who are keen to accumulate wealth, insist on throwing you in battles and killing your souls in Iraq and Afghanistan, and, God willing, on your own own land." I just want to remind people that as we get away from 9/11 and 2001, we'd not forget that we're still very much in a war on terrorism, and people are very much at war against us. And we're talking about probably one of the lead techniques we can use in this war, which I would note recent testimony General Hayden said that this about the technique of the information you're using right now. He said, quote, "Had this program been in effect prior to 9/11, it's my professional judgment that we would have detected some of the 9/11 al-Qaeda operatives in the United States, and we would have identified them as such." Mr. Attorney General, I don't know if you have a different opinion from General Hayden on that, but
I never have a different opinion from General Hayden on the intel capabilities that we're talking about here. Both he and Director Mueller have recently testified about the importance of the terrorist surveillance program. Now, General Hayden did say it's been very successful, that we've gotten information we would not have otherwise gotten, that it has helped us, I think he said, deter and detect attacks here and abroad. FBI Director Mueller said that it was a valuable tool, had helped identify would-be terrorists in the United States, and helped identify individuals providing material support to terrorists. So those are the experts saying how valuable this tool has been.
Having said that, I've read through most of your white paper material, and I've looked at a great deal of it. I'm struck, and I think we have an issue we need to deal with. Part of what we're working off of is a war declaration dated September 18, 2001, and the war declaration on Afghanistan, and the war declaration October 16, 2002, on the use of military force in Iraq, and all necessary force, and all necessary President is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks. It strikes me that we're going to be in this war on terrorism possibly for decades. Maybe not, but this could be the Cold War of our generation. Maybe it doesn't go that period of time, but it has the possibilities of going for some extended period of time. And I share Senator DeWine's concern that we should look then at the FISA law and make sure that as we move forward in this, that we're not just depending upon these authorizations of war to say that that puts us in a superior position under the Article II powers, but that to maintain the support of the American public, to have another set of eyes also looking at this surveillance technique is an important thing in maintaining the public's support for this. And so I want to look and direct you to looking at the FISA law in particular. And you've made some comments here this morning, I think have been today, that have been very well stated and thought through. You've talked at one point not well. The FISA law was not well structured to the needs of today's terrorist war effort. Law was passed, 27 years ago or something of that nature, and certainly didn't contemplate a war on terrorism like we're in today. And I want to look specifically at how we could amend that FISA law, looking at a possible decades-long war on terrorism. Now, one of the areas you've talked about that's cumbersome is the 72-hour provision within the law, if I'm gathering what you're saying correctly. Congress extended this period from 24 to 72 hours in 2001. Just looking narrowly at what would need to be done to use the FISA authority more broadly and still be able to stop terrorists, if that is extended further, would it make it more likely that you would use the FISA process if that's extended beyond 72 hours?
It's hard to say, Senator, because it's, you know, whether it's 24, 72, whatever, I have got to make a determination under the law that at the time I grant emergency authorization, that all the requirements of FISA are met. I think General Hayden said it best yesterday. This is not a 72-hour sort of hall pass. I've got to know when I grant that authorization, whether I then have 24 or 72 hours to submit a written application to the court, I've got to know at the time I say yes, go forward, that all the requirements of FISA are met. That's the problem. If I could just also make one final point.
Fair enough.
There was not a war declaration either in connection with Al-Qaeda or in Iraq. It was an authorization to use military force. I only want to clarify that because there are implications. Obviously, when you talk about a war declaration, you're possibly talking about affecting treaties, diplomatic relations, and so there is a distinction in law and in practice, and we're not talking about a war declaration. This is an authorization only to use military force.
Looking forward in the war on terrorism and the use of FISA and this committee's desire, I believe, to have the administration wherever possible and more frequently use FISA, and you noted you've used it more this past year than the year before. What specific areas would make this decision on your part easier, more likely to use the FISA process?
Well, Senator, if you're talking about domestic surveillance in a peacetime situation, for other kinds of terrorists beyond Al-Qaeda.
I'm talking about on terrorism.
Senator, I would like the opportunity to think about that and maybe talk to the experts in the department, I think, who would have a better sense about what kinds of specific things. I can say that that the Patriot Act includes a provision which allows these orders to stay in place a longer period of time before they're renewed. It is quite burdensome. The fact that these things expire, we didn't have to go back and get a renewal. That just places an additional burden on our staff. But I would like to have the opportunity to get back to you about what other kinds of specific changes might be helpful.
Well, if you could, because I think we're going to be in this for a period of time, and we're going to be in it for succeeding administrations in this war on terrorism. And probably our most valuable tool that we have is information, early information. To be able to cut this off. And so the American public, I think, clearly wants us to be able to get as much information as we can. And yet I think we need to provide a process that has as much security to the American public that there's no abuse in this system. This is about us trying to protect people and protect people in the United States. And I want to note, too, presidential authority that you're protecting. This has been talked about by Clinton administration attorney general before many others. I mean, it's not just this administration at all, as others have specifically quoted. But I do think as this wears on, we really need to have those thoughts at how we can make the FISA system work better.
Senator, we are as likewise concerned about ensuring that we protect the rights of all Americans.
I'm sure you are, and I appreciate that. I want you to protect us from security attacks, too. And bin Laden has, to my knowledge, when he normally makes a threat, he has followed through on these. This is a very active and live area. So we'll see if we can make that law change where it can work for a long-term war on terrorism. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And you've been listening to live coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the Bush administration's domestic eavesdropping program. We're going to bring you settlement prices now from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Merck. And then following the closing market report, we will pick up where we've left off just now. So if you're interested in the committee hearing, stay tuned and we'll pick up just now where we have left off. We're recording where we've left off, and we'll pick it up right there. You won't miss anything. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and let's take a look at what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade, and that's coming up in just a moment here with Todd Gleason.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Bezdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Okay, Todd Gleason, what kind of prices did we see today in the grains?
Well, kind of an interesting day after last week's upturn in the market, Celeste. Bean futures on this Monday afternoon managed to lose 7 to 8 cents. We'll talk during the closing market report at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon with Kurt Kimmel about the reasons why the bean market might be down and what happened in the corn and the wheat. They held fairly strong, but they did manage to lose today as well, down a penny in the wheat. The corn down about 2 since across most of that pit. The complete numbers like this from Kansas City. We'll start there. The March wheat, a high today of 421.5, a low at 411. Their settlement price at 432, and they were up 20.5 cents today. The July contract at 424, the high, the low at 413. Settlement price there at 418.25. And this is more in line with what I think happened in the rest of that pit in Kansas City. They were up a penny and a quarter. We'll check that 20.5 cents to make sure that that's correct. March wheat, 360, the high, the low at 353. And a March wheat settlement price in Chicago down 1.5 of the day. The May futures, a 370.75 high, low at 365. Settlement price at 365.75. And they were down 2 for the day. July contract, a 380.5 high, low at 374. Settlement price at 375.5, down 2.5 cents. And the September's 390, the high, low at 383. Settlement price there at 385. They were off 3. December contract, a 401.5 high, low at 395.5. Settlement price at 397.5. And they finished the day a penny lower. Let's take a look back at that Kansas City contract. That 20.5 just didn't look right. In fact, it wasn't. The March contract there is up 6 cents, not up 20.5 cents. I don't know where that came from. 421.5, the high, the low at 411. Settlement price at 417.5, 6 cents higher for that March wheat in Kansas City. That takes a lot less explanation than a 20 cent jump, I guarantee it. Corn pit now. March contract, 227.5, the high, the low at 221.75, settlement price at 222.75, they were down 2.5 for the day. May futures, a 236.5 high, low at 231.5, settlement price at 233 off 2. In July, 245, the high, the low at 40.5, a settlement price in the corn pit for the July at 2.25 lower, 241.75. September futures, 250.25, the high, the low at $2.48, settlement price at 248.25, down 1.75. In December contract, 260.75, the high, the low at 57. Settlement price at $2.58.5. They were off a penny and a half. And the March futures down 1.5 today. 265, the high, the low at 62.5. And a settlement price at 64.25. March oats, 202.75, the high, the low at $1.99. Settlement price at 201.75. They were off a quarter for the day. The May futures down, up 2.75 there. at $2.50 for the May oats. Soy complex now. Bean futures finished down 7 to 8 cents today. 597, the high in the March, the low at 583, settled 587. They were off 7.75. The May futures off 7 at $6.50, with 610 on the high, the low at 597. And July, 620, the high, the low at 606.5. Settlement price at 609.75. They were down 7.75. August, soybeans, 615, the high, the low at 611. Settled a penny above that at 612, down 8.5 cents for the day. And September's down 8.75. 614.5, the settlement price, the high at 16, the low at 14. November beans, $6.32.5, the high, low at 618. Settlement price at 621.75. They were off 8.75 for the November bean contract. January futures, 628.5, the high, the low at 24.5, and a settlement price at $6.25. They were off 8.5 cents today. The March bean meal, a 184.30 high, low at 180.20, settlement price at 181, down $3 today. The May bean meal down 310 at 183.60. The March bean oil at 22.85 high, low at 22.25, settlement price at 22.57. They were off 9, and the May bean oil down 10 at 22.97. I'll be back at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock, during the closing market report. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel about the marketplace, and we'll tell you how you can pledge your financial support to the ag programming right here on WILL AM 580. In just a moment, we'll get the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
Mostly higher day today for the livestock contracts on the Merck, the contracts that we cover here on AM 580. Two exceptions, February live cattle and February pork bellies, finished lower today. March feeder cattle, the high was 108.57.5, the low 107.52.5, finishing at 108.05, that up 22.5. April, 109.60, the high, 108.30, the low, 109.20, the settlement, that up 40. May, 109.50, the high, 108.15, the low, 109.10, the settlement, that up 22.5. February live cattle, 92.25, the high, 91.80, the low, 92.15, the settlement, that off 12.5 cents. April, 90.20, the high, 89.37.5, the settlement, 89.87.5, the settlement, that up 2.5. February lean hogs, 55.75, the high, 54.95, the low, 55.62.5, the settlement, that up 60. April, 61.35, the high, 60.60, the low, 61.32.5, the settlement, that up 60. May lean hogs, 66.80, the high, 66.10, the low, 66.77.5, the settlement, that up 37.5. And June lean hog, 68.55, the high, 67.90, the low, 68.52.5, the settlement, that finishing up 35 cents. And February belly, 77.85, today's high, the low, 76 even, finishing at 76.90, that down 2.5. The Dow is up a fraction, the NASDAQ is off 9, the S&P 500 off a fraction.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses,